Good morning, everybody. I'd like to welcome everybody to Senate Finance. It's 9 minutes after 9 a.m. Friday, April 4th, 2008. With me today is my co-chair, Senator Hoffman, Senator Huggins, and Senator Dyson. Senator Olson is at a previous arranged engagement, and Senator Elton will be joining us shortly. This morning we have three bills on the agenda. We have Senate Bill 218, Child Safety Seat and Seat Belts, and we'll move on to Senate Bill 226, Vexatious Litigants, and then House Bill 326, Military National Guards Fighting Wildlife Fires. We're going to start today with Senate Bill 218, Child Safety Seats and Seat Belts. This is the first hearing on this bill, and after hearing from the sponsor, we're going to take public testimony, and then we'll look to the committee for their will. And if we could start, Senator Hoffman, with a motion on the CS, please.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Finance Committee adopt CS for Senate Bill 218 /C as our working document.
We have or I'll object for explanation. And the CS was brought forward by the bill sponsor, Senator French, and if Senator French could come forward and hit on the CS for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning. For the record, my name is Hollis French. I represent West Anchorage in the State Senate. With me is Allison Biostock, my staffer, and the person who's done the heavy lifting on this bill.
Okay, and could you explain CS, please?
The
changes in it, and then we'll move to adopt it, and then we'll go to the bill.
The changes in the CS are the the CS before the committee clarifies the ages required to use a booster seat. Under the bill, under the original bill, you could have wound up with a small 15-year-old child who would be required by law to use a booster seat, and we thought that was just completely unrealistic, and so we made an adjustment to the bill to deal with kids who are over 8 years old who don't meet the height and weight requirements now can use a booster or seat belt, whichever is appropriate, leaving that decision up to the parents. In addition, it should help law enforcement who would simply have to inquire as to a child's age instead of having to size them up as to their weight. So that was the change in the CS, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I'll go ahead and remove my objection to the adoption of the CS. Do we have any further objection to the adoption of the CS? Seeing none, CS version C is adopted as our working draft. And Senator French, if you could walk us through the bill and explain to us what we have before the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In essence, the bill tries to take into account the fact that when children use adult seat belts in the place of a proper child safety restraint device, injuries occur. While any restraint is better than no restraint, the use of a proper child safety seat and booster seat can prevent injuries. Current Alaska law states that children under four must be secured in a safety device, meeting U.S. Department of Transportation standards. The bill before you places those Department of Transportation guidelines into the statute. There's a chart in your packet which outlines which device is appropriate for which child, and it just makes it clear that babies go in rear-facing seats just as now. Infants go in a normal child seat that I think we're all used to. It's the next category that hasn't been protected very well under the law, and that's kids that are a little too big for those baby seats. And yet not big enough for a seatbelt. They sit too low in the ground. The shoulder strap comes up against their chin. Kids will take that shoulder strap and put it behind them, and then they're only restrained by a lap belt. So the idea is to say, get a little booster seat, and to help you understand what we're talking about, Mr. Chairman, we brought an example of one. We ran down to Walmart, bought ourselves a booster seat. This is the device we're talking about. There are more complex ones, but this piece of plastic here on the table would comply exactly with the bill you have before you. The American Academy of Pediatrics has stated that booster seats are 60% safer than seatbelts alone. 38 states currently mandate booster seat use. We are not trying to make this onerous. The first offense, if you will, is a fix-it ticket. That is, go get a booster seat. The ticket goes away. You're now in compliance. And so, you know, we're just trying to encourage folks to do the right thing without being too heavy-handed about it. Since I'm in front of the Finance Committee, I'll point out that the fiscal note before you points out that we would be eligible for about $200,000 a year in federal funds should we adopt this measure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, and that was one of the questions I had. We were going to touch on the fiscal note, so it's good. Do we have questions for the bill sponsor? Senator Thomas, and before Senator Thomas's question, let the record show that Senator Thomas and Senator Olson and Senator Elton are at the table.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator French, I'm assuming there are some kind of standards, federal standards or something, or federal guidelines, or at least some transportation commission or something that has done studies and kind of gives you some guidance in arriving at these particular ages and weights and sizes and stuff. Is that correct? I'm just curious. I would assume that was the case where you derived some of these numbers and things from. So,
through the chair, Senator Thomas, we in essence reached out and grabbed the United States Department of Transportation guidelines, relying on their research, their studies, and simply put them into statute. And really, on the bill, it's page 2, subsection 3, lines 3 to 8. That's really the new thing we're adding to the law. It's on page 2, subsection 3. If you're over 4 years old, yeah, under 8 years old, if you're less than a certain height, less than a certain weight, you need one of these booster seats to get you up to where your seatbelt actually restrains that young person's body in the event of a crash.
Thank you.
Senator Hoffman, and then Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Say you're in Antioch, and then you get cited with this, and you run to the store, and there's no seatbelts available. So what happens when in that instance, and what happens if you don't comply? What are the penalties for non-compliance?
I'm going to turn to my staffer who's got all those numbers up. I believe it's $25. It's a $25 fix-it ticket. So the $25 ticket goes away.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, it's a $50 fine, and the first offense is a fix-it ticket. The second offense is there's no fix-it option. You just have to pay the fine. Understanding that there might be stores without booster seats in Antioch, I know that they're available online.
And how long does it take to order one online to hit Antioch?
I'll jump in and say I'll defer to your wisdom on that. I don't know.
Probably at least a month.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I want to carry greetings over. I was just addressing went over to see the state medical board, and so they're obviously very interested in issues just like this because of children coming in. And I know since I've had a child, the seat that I put him in, he certainly is better equipped to go ahead and deal with a problem than we have in the past. And I have had the same question. You know, if a person is, you talk about online, if you go out to some of the villages there, what kind of provisions are there for them to comply where you don't even have state-maintained roads, let alone internet, to go ahead and get online? And they're doing good to have Staples down at the store, especially in the spring of the year. And I have to tell you the truth, I've never seen a child safety seat or a booster seat outside of Nome, and you've got 66 villages out in that
Senator French, could we have your trusty staff put her name on the record?
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. For the record, my name is Allison Biostock, staff to Senator Hollis French.
Okay, thank you.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, the issue is as pertinent to the booster seats as they are to child seats, as they are to infant seats. If what you're telling me is that the infant and child seats are routinely ignored in Bush, Alaska, then I think that the booster seat requirement would be ignored as well. If the police are not, you know, harassing people because of the slow speeds that those people drive on, roads in the bush, if, you know, the community's kind of come to a decision that that's not a priority of law enforcement, I can't see this bill changing that. It would still be strictly on the books, but so it is for infants and for children. And so this doesn't change anything. It does exempt vehicles not meant for highway use, so obviously ATVs and snow machines would be captured here, but it pertains equally statewide to operation on a state road.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Do we have any other questions for the bill sponsor before we go to the off-net? Okay, with that, we'll go to Anchorage. Peggy Hayashi, please, if you could identify yourself and who you represent and speak to the bill.
My name is Peggy Hayashi, and I am a registered nurse, retired, and I represent myself as well as childhood injury prevention programs that I work for across the state as a volunteer. I have been an emergency nurse for 42 years, and during that time, I also have been a childhood injury prevention statewide coordinator. And we have seen, since this program, injury prevention childhood, began in 1987, we have seen the critical injuries that occur to children in the emergency room as well as out of the emergency room in rehab hospitals. We have worked with families. So I've seen both sides of it. I've seen it from a personal level as well as from a professional level. I've seen the high cost of health care to the uninsured and as well as the insured, not only the trauma to families, but everything that they've experienced in the loss of a child or the critical injury of a child. The current law as it stands is rather, people have a difficulty understanding it. And so this is meant as a clarification of current law to make it specific to booster seats as well. And we want to put into easy, quick words what law enforcement, what families, what child care providers, what the general population can understand. And I understand your concerns about rural Alaska. Native health is very much a part of what we're doing. I have to say that any child in Alaska, low-income child, high-risk child who needs a car seat, a booster seat, has access to it within the state. You don't necessarily have to go in line. You can call any of the child care providers, child passenger safety educators across the state. I am the state resource for NHTSA, and we'll make sure that a car seat or a booster seat, rather, gets to a child in not a month, but just a matter of time. We, you know, we're talking booster seats that cost anyway from $17 to $117. So there's a wide range of availability and prices. The network that we have out there has been collecting data. These are people who are educated as technicians and child care instructors, fire, police, state troopers, BPSO, EMS, again, emergency physicians, nurses, the AAP, the Alaska Automobile Dealers Association, the military bases and forts, which already has it as a law, public health, and volunteers all across the state who work with families on a daily basis have found this misunderstanding, this confusion that has led in some cases to a tragedy. And we're simply here to clarify what our current law says, not change it drastically. And if there are any questions, please go ahead.
Okay, thank you. We do have a question from Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would assume from your testimony then that the concept of a $17 or even $100 booster chair would be well worth it compared to even somebody that is insured in even a minor accident that takes place where a child is taken to the hospital or even to see a doctor over what would be considered a very minor injury but just to be checked out.
Exactly. I was recently in the emergency room with a laceration, a small one to my forehead, and it cost, I can't tell you how many, several hundreds of dollars, and I still haven't gotten all the bills. So a $17 car seat is really, you know, worthwhile. And as I said, we have, through grants and through donations, we've made available hundreds of seats to people throughout Alaska. I would almost venture thousands at this point over the last 10 years to seats throughout Alaska.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, thank you for your testimony, Ms. Hayashi.
Thank you.
We'll now go to Kenai LIO, Gordon Glaser.
Glaser. Good morning, Chairman, members of the Finance Committee. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. My name is Gordon Glazer. I work for the State of Alaska Division of Public Health and Injury Prevention Programs for Children. I'm speaking today as a member of the Booster Seat Legislative Committee, and it's a coalition of different groups trying to clarify our booster legislation so that it's more understandable for parents and law enforcement. I appreciate being able to use the Kenai Legislative Office. I'm down here doing a training for hospital staff and firefighters, and if you know anyone down here who would like to have their child seat or booster seat checked today from 11 to 4, we'll be at the Kenai Fire Department. Why this legislation is so important is that it doesn't add any new penalties. It just clarifies something that's very confusing. And it's an important issue because motor vehicle-related injuries are the second leading cause of hospitalization and the leading cause of fatalities for Alaska children. Nothing is so sad. Few things are so sad as to talk to a parent who said, I thought the law said I didn't have to have it. And when I talked to someone, having the present statute, which just says, look at the Department of Transportation guidelines, is not a realistic option for those people trying to figure out the law. What the statute clarification is, spells out quite clearly what needs to be done. And giving the parent the opportunity to know what the law is, to understand the law. So I would hope you all would consider seriously this clarification to make it more understandable for Alaska parents what they need to do for their child. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Fisher. That concludes our off-net and LIO list. We do have, as mentioned earlier, we do have one fiscal note from DOT showing $194,000 in federal receipts as a result of passage of this bill. Do we have any other questions for the bill sponsor, Senator Elton?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I predicate my question by saying I'm not an attorney, so I'm looking kind of at the sponsor. Two issues that have kind of been bubbling around in my mind. If in fact there is an accident, if in fact a parent was driving and didn't have what is required in law, does that and the child is injured, does that elevate a tragedy to a crime? For example, if a parent is driving or the driver is impaired by alcohol, I mean, all of a sudden you go from a tragedy to a crime. Does the same thing occur with this?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, it's an excellent question. I think the answer is, unfortunately, as in so many matters, it depends. It depends on, you know, I doubt it would be the presence or absence of a booster seat which caused a DA to make a charging decision in an accident. Typically, you pointed out, it's where alcohol is involved. A parent who drives impaired, of course, is committing the crime of DWI, but they're also committing the crime of reckless endangerment with respect to the other passengers. If there's a crash and those passengers are injured, we frequently, at the DA's office, brought charges, usually in the most egregious cases, not an offender bender, but I'm personally aware of cases where a driver was charged for the loss of someone they loved. And it's a horrible case to bring, but you can see when you study the statutes that driver, that drunk driver, has caused the death of another through their own reckless actions. And you could conceive of that situation happening with a parent and their children. It's hard for me to imagine a situation where the booster seat suddenly the defining fact or absence thereof.
And then, Mr. Chair, a follow-up question. I mean, does this would this implicate, for example, a person's insurance policy? If the insurance company came back and said, "Well, you didn't follow the law, therefore we're not responsible for the cost of hospitalization."
Through the chair, I think the short answer is no. I think the short answer is if you're, you know, the insurance company can't say, you know, you weren't wearing a seatbelt and you got injured, therefore I'm not paying for your injuries, right? And so by the same, I think by the same theory, they'd have a hard time denying coverage for a child who was injured. You know, I can imagine a cold-hearted insurance person who might try that, but I don't think it would be successful.
I have a difficult time imagining a cold-hearted insurance person, I guess, Mr. Thank you.
And do we have any other questions? Yeah. Senator Hoffman, will of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Finance Committee pass out CS for Senate Bill 218 /C with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
We have a motion to move the bill from committee with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations. Do we have objection? Seeing no objection, we'll go ahead and move the bill from committee. We'll now pick up Senate Bill 266, Vexatious Litigants. We've heard this bill for the first time on February 20th. We set this bill aside to allow the committee members the opportunity to hear from the public and work with the bill sponsor on any concerns they may have. We haven't had any concerns brought to our office concerning this bill, and I'd like to invite the bill sponsor, Senator French, to come forward. And then if Senator French, if you could, after you put your self on the record, if you could explain this bill again for the folks at home that may have not been watching on February 20th or may have forgotten, if they had the contents of this bill, please, and remind the committee also.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And again, my name is Hollis French. I represent West Anchorage in the State Senate. Senate Bill 226 is designed to give the court system a way to control their docket with a tool that allows them to view vexatious litigants as just that, individuals who are abusing the court system by filing repetitive cases against an ever-expanding number of people who refuse to acknowledge the fact that they've lost and it's time to move on, who add new claims without any new facts to back those claims up, and cause a fairly high degree of consternation for the individuals involved and a high degree of cost for the system to maintain you know, judges and clerks and an apparatus to hear those claims over and over again, despite the fact that they're legally meritless. So the bill, in essence, puts a new rule into place modeled after a California law that's been on the books for many years now, and just allows judges, in essence, to act as a gatekeeper when an individual has lost a certain number of cases in a row and nothing has changed except for their own, and nothing's changed. Okay. I just point out that there's a representative here from the Department of Law who can answer questions. I'm happy to answer questions as well. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Right. I see here on the list, and we have a zero fiscal note. We've already had a public testimony on this bill, and do we have anybody from the audience that would like to come forward and speak on this bill? Do we have any questions from the committee members? Senator Hoffman, the will of the committee.
Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Finance Committee pass out Senate Bill 226 with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
And we have a motion to move the bill from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. Do we have objection? Senator Huggins has objection. Can you want to speak to your objection?
If I could, just for the record at a minimum, and I've talked to Senator French about this before, on line or page 3, line 12 and 13, the definition of vexatious litigant still concerns me in the respect that it appears you can vaccinate yourself by having an attorney with you. I mean, if you literally read the definition, and I've heard the explanation of, well, the court system has a way to deal with that, but it seems odd to have the provision of being able to vaccinate yourself if you have your attorney along with you. And with that, I will remove my objection.
Okay. The objection has been removed. Do we have further objection to moving the bill? Okay. With that, we'll go ahead and move the bill from committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee.
We'll now go to House Bill 326, military National Guard fighting wildland fires. And this is the first hearing in Senate Finance. The intent is to hear from the administration, take public testimony, and if there's no concerns that come forward from the committee members, to go ahead and move this bill from committee. This bill is sponsored by the administration, and we have with us a representative from the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. And if you could go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and then walk us through the bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is McHugh Pierre. I'm the legislative liaison for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. I'd like to start by offering my most sincere thanks to you, Mr. Chairman, and the committee for taking on this bill this morning. This has really come to our attention in the year 2004 when we had record wildland forest fires. The way the firefighting process works, and I'm joined by Division Director of Forestry Chris Mache online as well, when the firefighting resources in the state are stretched to their most thin point and the fires need extra help, in between the time when resources can come from the lower 48 or from Canada to aid our existing resources in the state, the Division of Forestry and Department of Natural Resources calls on the Alaska National Guard to help fight these fires. In 2004, when we had such extreme wildfire conditions, we found that Guard members who were activated on state active pay were paid between one-fourth and one-half of what the firefighters were being paid for doing the exact same job. The commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources offered to pay our National Guard members the same wage. Most of this is federal money, and we thought that would be a fantastic opportunity to show our thanks for these volunteers to the fire line. The state statute prohibits that from occurring. This bill would change that. In Section 2 of this bill, that would make that change. In Section 1 of this bill, we would see the opportunity to allow our National Guard members to respond to the fire more quickly than in the past. It'll allow the governor to delegate the authority of calling up the National Guard to fight wildland fires to the Adjutant General and Commissioner of the Department of DMVA. When requested by Department of Natural Resources, the National Guard could respond in a more timely fashion to help save life and property. I'm available for any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Could you, I was shuffling paper, so maybe you mentioned this, but could you kind of give us a little synopsis again on how many times the National Guard is called up to fight these fires, and then will it have any effect on the civilian side? I know you mentioned the disparity of pay, but is there any negative effects on the civilian side?
Mr. Chairman, if I could, I'd like to start and just say this will not affect the civilian sector at all. We are the very last line of defense called. So when the National Guard does engage in the wildland fire suppression efforts, all of the civilian, all of the state resources are being enacted to fight the fire, and then we are the very last line. And Division Director Chris Mache, I believe, is on the phone to answer some more questions about how frequently we are used, and really it's a very small amount of time.
And do we have any questions? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Probably not a question. Sounds more like a equal pay for equal work kind of situation to me, you know. And I don't know actually who's paying the tab, but it would seem that if at this point in time they're paid less, they would probably be called in first or earlier to be reducing the overall payroll that goes out or something like that. And thereby they might impact other folks that would be called first. But anyhow, it's just my
Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple points for clarification. I see the Chief Warrant Officer 5 would make more than an 06 on a daily rate as an example. That seems odd.
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, it is odd. Really, the CW5s are the subject matter experts, as you well know, and oftentimes on the fire line, you won't see an 06, a colonel, or even a lieutenant colonel, for that matter, responding. Usually a Chief Warrant Officer 5 does not respond either. The usual crew members we have, and you can see this set up, there's a packet, there's a paper like this in your packet. Our usual crew staffing is one Black Hawk helicopter, one pilot in command, one pilot, and one chief engineer or crew officer there in the back. The most high-ranking person is usually the pilot, and they happen to be a chief warrant officer 3, sometimes a chief warrant officer 4 on the fire lines. So you can see the difference in pay there. The CW3 makes $1,493 per week under the state active duty rates, and the chief warrant officer 4 makes $1,635 per week. Now you compare that, as Senator Thomas brought up, the equal pay for equal work. The EFF, BLM, or the Division of Forestry pilots that are contracted that might be private citizens working for Evergreen Helicopters are making $3,734 per week. They're doing the same job. They're fighting the same fire. They're using different helicopters, but we use our equipment. They use their equipment with what they're trained, and we just like to make equal pay for equal work, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Follow up with Senator Huggins and then Senator Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's another category of people, and that's the full-timers that go do this mission. And then that, I think that complicates the situation a little bit. And in fact, full-timers could be taking a pay cut to go do this job. But would you talk to us about that quickly? Sir,
through the chair, Senator Huggins. That is the truth. The goal of this is to make sure that we have traditional National Guardsmen responding to fight these wildfires. Now, there's two levels of pay here that you see in our department. You see National Guard members who are under federal pay. They're either technicians or they're active guard and reserve. They're determined by the Department of Defense to be key positions to make sure that the National Guard functions at the appropriate level so the entity, the institution, does not collapse. These people, when they do accept this job, they do go to state active duty rates, and it's a different mission. And so they would change pay classes. They would leave their federal pay to move to the state active duty rates. They could be taking a pay cut, that is correct, but we certainly understand that it's the appropriate way to do business.
One follow-up, Senator Huggins. You're on a roll this morning.
And there's one other element. I just want to do this for the record because people have talked to me about it. I mean, I don't know that much about it other than the tip of the iceberg. As I recall, some people actually have to take leave to do this.
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, yes, that's correct. If you are a technician, however, I'd like to point out that in the department, within the National Guard, you've got no more than 15% who are full-time. They're either technicians under federal pay or they're AGR, active guard and reserve, that are on federal pay. So if one of those people are asked to take on this mission, then they would have to file for leave to go fight this fire. We're trying to get away from that because really what we see here in the department overall with the National Guard, we see the active duty or the folks who are full-timers, if you will, taking most of these jobs and not allowing the opportunity for the part-timers to get the training they need, to take on the missions that they need to be successful. And quite frankly, the part-timers make up the majority of the National Guard, as you see in your districts, and they're part of the Guard because they truly love what they're doing, and they want to participate, and we're trying to make sure that the full-timers acknowledge that, don't hoard these missions to themselves, but go out to the members of the National Guard that might be working in your businesses that would take leave from their jobs and go do this mission.
Just as a summation comment, that is a worthy goal, and it's very, very true because the full-timers are there and they know everything's going on. But it is unfortunate in some cases that people are mandatorily said, you, CW4 Joe Thomas, go. And they're activated, and they have to take vacation to go do that. And I'm not saying we can fix that, but we need to be aware of the parameters that we're putting some people in. This is a good fix. I support that. But it's a larger story that people are subjected to, and I just wanted to make sure that we at least mentioned that.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you look at this bill and realizing that these people that are out there actually working with other jobs and employed elsewhere, have you heard back from those business owners or those employers that are out there that are going to be affected by these people having to go out there and become smoke eaters, essentially?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, yes, sir, we have. And in fact, we don't mandate that for the majority of the time, we have yet to mandate folks respond to wildfires. This is strictly volunteer. So we depend on the member in the National Guard to go to their employer and say, excuse me, sir, I'd appreciate if I could take the next 3 days off to help fight this wildland fire. and we have not had any complaints from employers in local communities saying this is a problem. All the employers have so far encouraged it, welcomed it, and supported their employees as citizen soldiers.
Last question, Mr. Chairman, has to do with whether what are other states do in a similar situation where they have wildland fires out there in the lower 48 and they're called on, and they call on some kind of militia or the National Guard to go and help activate.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, other states react in the same way. They would activate their members on a state active duty rate, and they are the very last line of defense the same way that we have. The difference between our state and, say, California is that California's state active duty rates may be different. We haven't updated our state active duty rates in some time, and we don't necessarily see the need to respond to that right now. What we see is that our state active duty rates don't match the firefighting rates in this particular instance. And this, by no means, Senator Olson, is the tip of the iceberg to change that entire structure. We realize that this is a very unique situation and that we want to make sure that the folks are paid evenly across the board.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Other questions for the bill sponsor? Senator Elton.
thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, we've all heard stories about the danger in fighting a wildland fire, forest fires. I mean, does this require the department to do specialized training for the forces so that they have a minimum amount of knowledge about what to expect and how to deal with the unexpected?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, this does not require any additional training outside of their current military training. The members who are called to fight the wildfires only respond in the capacity they're trained to do. So we do not cross-employ people. If you're trained as a pilot, you're going to respond to that fire as a pilot in the equipment that you're trained to respond in. You will not be put as a National Guard member in a job that you are not trained to do.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We have other questions for the bill sponsor? We have no call-ins other than departments for answers of questions, which we've had all the questions answered. I see no one in the audience that's interested in coming forward to speak. Any closing comments from the bill sponsor?
Mr. Chairman, I just appreciate the time of the committee today, and I appreciate your questions. I look forward to working with you in the future. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hoffman, a will of the committee?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Finance Committee pass out CS for House Bill 326 Finance with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Okay, we have a motion to move the bill from committee with the fiscal notes and individual recommendations. Do we have objection? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and move the bill from committee. Unless members have any other questions or comments, this concludes today's business. We're going to be posting the schedule for the next meeting. There may be a meeting tomorrow. We'll let you know as soon as we can. And if not tomorrow, we'll have a fairly full agenda next week. And we'll be here at 9 a.m. on Monday morning. And again, if there's a meeting that comes up for tomorrow, we'll try to post it by mid-afternoon so everybody can have time to adjust their schedule. With that, meeting adjourned.